Now I am alone. Oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I. Is it not monstrous that this player here, but in a fiction, in a dream of passion, could force his soul so to his own conceit that from its working all his visage wand, tears in his eyes, distraction in his aspect, a broken voice, and his whole function suiting with forms to his conceit, and all for nothing, for Hecuba. What's Hecuba to him, or he to Hecuba, that he should weep for her? What would he do had he the motive and the cue for passion that I have? He would drown the stage with tears, and cleave the general ear with horrid speech, make mad the guilty and appall the free, confound the ignorant and amaze indeed the very faculties of eyes and ears. Yet I, a dull and muddy metal rascal, peak like John o' Dreams, unpregnant of my cause, and can say nothing. No, not for a king, upon whose property and most dear life a damned defeat was made.
Was there ever such a master of self-reproach as Hamlet, and such a master of Hamlet as Sir John Gielgud, and such a master of the stage, the English language, and insight into human nature as William Shakespeare? Shakespeare died on April 23rd, 1616. That's 400 years ago this Saturday. That's one of the few things we seem to know for certain about the Bard of Avon. Scant biographical detail about him has survived across the centuries. We do know that he was born in April 1564, possibly on April 23rd, which would mean he may have died on his 52nd birthday. We know he didn't come from a particularly distinguished family or privileged circumstances, that he married Anne Hathaway and had three children with her, and that he wrote plays to pay the bills. We may have little information about his life, but Shakespeare has arguably done more to inform human life than anyone else in the secular world. The literary critic Harold Bloom has held that Shakespeare invented the human. The historian Simon Schama argues that Shakespeare invented England. And the literary historian Stephen Greenblatt has suggested that Shakespeare's greatest invention was himself, a dazzling genius that appears entirely self-created out of humble origin. Shakespeare's peers aren't just Sophocles, Dante, Cervantes, and James Joyce. They are Aristotle, Newton, Darwin, Freud, and Einstein. All the more is the burden on his actors, the conduit between that genius and the audience, which is all of the rest of us. We have two of the best Shakespearean actors in the business joining us this morning. Shauna McKenna is a Genie Award winner. She has appeared in dozens of plays at the Stratford Festival. Her roles have included Lady Macbeth, Olivia in Twelfth Night, Cordelia in King Lear, and the lead role in Richard III. This season at Stratford, she's appearing in As You Like It and Ibsen's John Gabriel Borkman. And Colm Feore is one of the country's most recognizable actors. He has portrayed Pierre Trudeau and Glenn Gould on screen. In addition, he has starred in a number of American television series, such as 24 and House of Cards, and movies such as The Amazing Spider-Man 2. But much of his most distinguished work has been at Stratford, where he's played Richard III, Hamlet, Macbeth, and King Lear, among many others. Colm Feore and Shauna McKenna are with me in our studio in Toronto. Hello, welcome.
Hello.
And welcome back. Hello. Our audience can't see this because it's radio, but while we were listening to Sir John Gielgud, the two of you were mouthing the words to each other.
Well, that was just to prove that we both knew them.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And we had slightly different rhythms and different interpretations.
Slightly different choices,
yeah,
I think.
John, yeah, John, he had some good ideas. Good
he
man,
did,
but, you know, we were a little bit more.
It was good. He spoke rapidly, quickly.
Give me an idea, if you will, on what it's like to say those words to an audience. Shauna, to say old Bill's text.
Well, I've never said Hamlet's words to an audience.
Not yet.
It'll happen.
No, I have been offered. I did not choose to do it. Transformation into a virile young man grieving for his father, I thought, was not as possible as perhaps transforming into a bunchback toad named Richard III. But it's extraordinary to actually have those words coming out of your mouth, to be the vessel for those words.
Is that what you are as the actor?
Yeah. I'm one of those old-fashioned types who believes you serve the playwright. You're the playwright's advocate.
And serve the text.
Serve the text. Yeah, I know, that's quaint. But it's it's kind of how I was brought into the theater world. So my teachers and the people I respected were all about how can we take this from the page to the stage, which is how these plays were meant to be. And it requires that old-fashioned word technique, because you want to be a living, breathing human being, but you're also speaking poetry. You're also speaking words that have been chosen with great care.
It seems that the most common adjective to describe a Shakespearean role is daunting. You hear that all the time. What is daunting about it, Noel?
Well, first and foremost, certainly the kind of parts that Sean and I have been lucky enough to play, your face time with an audience is rather long, and you have to find out what your entertainment value is pretty early on in the process. And it's a lot of work. It's just plain a lot of work. Physically, emotionally, and intellectually, they're very rigorous. You can't just kind of wander on and just say it. It should look like you wandered on and are just saying it.
Right.
But as Shauna said, there's an immense amount of technique that you then have to make look like it never happened. Like Picasso painting on glass backwards. Right? You go, it's just a couple of lines, no big deal. And that's what you have to learn to do. So the daunting part is when you say, sure, I'll sign for that. And then you think, that was the stupidest thing I ever did.
I quoted Harold Bloom, a great critic. Every time I interview him, he calls me dear. He talks about the human element of Shakespeare's work and how it makes us feel more human. Or how does that work?
Because he did understand human beings. People always ask that question, is Shakespeare relevant today? And I'm always slightly annoyed by it because I think, how many places can we set Romeo and Juliet in? Are there still refugees? Is there still war? Is there still loss, love, pain? And he expresses it with such economy and such psychological intuition. The Scottish play is so, can we say, ahead of its time? I mean, yeah. About, you know, crossing a line in the sand, a moral line in the sand that keeps disappearing as you cross it.
And indeed, one of his later plays, which got shorter and shorter and cleaner and leaner as he went, no, don't need that.
Don't need that.
I needed that in Othello. I needed it in Hamlet. Mm-hmm. No, don't need it. Don't need it. We could be out of here in an hour and 45.
That's right.
You know, and he'd be on the train back to Stratford. The thing, too, that I find fascinating about Shakespeare and how to justify the relevance is it's a simple fact. One lifetime is not long enough to know what we know. It just isn't. We are a cultural learning creature.
Right.
So we, by definition, and this is now scientifically proven, the culture gene coevolution kind of thinking, but we build on everything that has passed. We build on it, whether we understand the patterns and the repetitions or not. So when you're looking to be fully human, you're looking for example. To whom are you looking? You're looking, as we looked from out of our caves, to the prestigious one, the leader, the ring giver. You're talking, you know, a leader. Why are they leading? Because they've got more jaws of yak glued up outside, nailed up outside their tent or their cave. We think, I'll follow him, do what she does. She knows how to chew corn, make beer. Okay. You know, suddenly we build on stuff that is 10, 12, 15,000 years old. Shakespeare.
So we hear the phrase that Shakespeare's character, Falstaff and Hamlet and Richard III, they're larger than life. But what you're both saying is that they are life. They contain, his work contains all of life.
I think it's always, you know, when you have something traumatic happen, or when you're going through an experience such as grief, or you're going to a funeral, or you're going to a wedding, Shakespeare is often quoted because I think Shakespeare can articulate emotions and feelings. Sometimes we can't. And you look to someone who can.
What did Johnson say of him? What oft was thought, but ne'er so well expressed.
Yeah. You know, I remember listening to a Saskatchewan farmer talking about a flood when the floods were a few years ago. And he said, well, it was just awful. And I thought, now he sounds as articulate as Macduff saying horror, 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 or Lear saying never, 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 but totally articulate in the repetition of that word. Shakespeare then gives you Titania's speech about how climate change has destroyed the world, and it's because of our actions, our human actions. So it hits you in the face when she describes that flood. and you respond to it because it's economical. It's in so few words. And if we can't articulate those emotions, do we risk losing them?
But how do you, when, as performers, as actors, how do you bring your own sensibility, your own sense of what it is to be human, to the greatest writer, greatest playwright who ever lived?
First of all, you have to find out, as Sean has said, when you're serving the author's intention, if you know what the author's intention is. Do you know what he's actually talking about? Do you understand the words that he chose? And here's the character, the daunting part, the Hamlet, the Juliet, the Lear. They're here. You're over here.
Right.
I said on radio with two hands extended in opposite directions.
Indeed.
But during the course of rehearsals and studying and collaborating with your colleagues, you're going to move those two creatures together. And you're going to bring and infuse. Keep in mind, Hamlet needs a voice. He needs a body. He needs some real live expression. I've agreed to be that cipher, that, you know, vessel for him.
But what is the difference between playing a Shakespeare character and playing Blanche DuBois or Willy Loman? What's the difference?
Now, it's funny because I love playing Blanche DuBois. I played it twice. And I tell you, I must say, I almost sometimes prefer Tennessee Williams to Shakespeare because he writes such fabulous women. And it's because in our vernacular, but he's still a poet, Tennessee Williams plays with rhythms and words and the surreal as much as Shakespeare does. But I think Shakespeare, you have to bring the same skills.
Right.
You have to be a human being first, and then you have to use your skills to serve it up, to appreciate that, oh, he's used three T's in this sentence. That means there's bite in that sentence, or he's used a lot of vowels right here. Maybe that's a little more saying something else.
Does that mean then you're welded to the text? There's no element for you to...
Bernard Hopkins said, obviously there's the text. He was a mentor and friend, and he had a great expression about it. We're all playing the same music. It's the bowing. It's the bowing that's different.
Right.
And you can tell different artists the way they... I mean, listen to the way we followed along with Sir John, both admiring the way he did the thing, admiring it for how admired he was à l'époque, and also improving here or there where we thought we might, that was a good choice in 53, but actually in 75 and 95, I would have done something else.
Do you know that story of Olivier was playing Macbeth at the Old Vic and Gielgud was in the audience and he went backstage and he said, Larry, you nailed that one. It was wonderful. It was wonderful. And Olivier said, I know, Johnny, but I don't know why. Has that ever happened to you?
Well, when you have a great night or when you feel good, you sort of go, I don't know what happened there. I don't know if I could repeat it. And that's all right, because you don't want to repeat it. You want to be there for the moment.
But if you're doing it for 40 nights or something in a season, when you were doing Lear, do you make it different every night? Or
hopefully, because it's live. Right? Different group of people show up, right? Everybody's in a different way. One of the things I was most proud of with Lear, particularly, because it was a watershed moment for me at what I thought would be the end of a career. I'm still here. It's all right. But I thought, well, I'll go out always trying to be better. And that means new minting it. I was very lucky to be surrounded by people like Scott Wentworth, Stephen Wimette, Johnny Goad, Evan Bewling, and Matt Beattie. Lovely, lovely, wonderful people who agreed to go on this journey. And the journey was, I haven't got a clue. I'm going to say, give me the map there, and this is going to be Christmas, and it'll be great. And occasionally Bob King, God love him, would give it to me upside down, and I wouldn't recognize my own country and give the wrong bits away. I'd say, Bob, are you screwing with me? He's like, what are you even talking about? No, no. But so that obviously it's going to be different.
But when you get together, you've decided to do a play, you do Richard III, or you're doing Lear, or whatever, and you're sitting around, it's a table reading, or you've got the crew and the director and everybody, what do you talk about?
Blue Jays.
Really?
There's a lot of that. And then the damn, you know, hockey games.
The first day, you know, it's different. You know, sometimes you don't read the play the first day. Sometimes you do. Some different directors have different ways of approaching it. But, you know, I am of the mind that a first day is the first time you hear those voices. Because as much as we are watching the play, you know, it was called an audience. And with Shakespeare, you're hearing the play. They say you go to hear the play. Because we could turn off the lights and still tell you the story with the words.
Right.
So you are hearing these voices together for the first time in a room. And I think you should, you know, sometimes they say no acting required. And I go, well, if you've made a choice or you have a choice in mind, let's go for it. Let's see what happens, because you can change it. It's the theater.
And I struggle. I struggle with understanding Shakespeare when I'm just there alone reading it, and I find that one has to read it out loud just to be able to get an idea of what's going on. The first reading is for me that moment. Ah, I'm talking to you. She's talking to her. That right. They're all. You start to see the lightning connections of who's talking to who, and suddenly the whole thing comes to life.
What did you do in high school when you were told you've got to read this play? It's called Much Ado About Nothing, and it's in a funny language, and you have to read it and report on.
You know what? I went to a very enlightened high school
They put out. It shows.
Let me explain this to you.
Yes, it certainly
They put
does.
Out the Victrola, and they put the Cadman recordings of the BBC and Sir John and all his pals, and they said, "This is Much Ado About Nothing. You'll enjoy it." And the teacher lit his pipe, put the record on, and pissed off. And I thought, well, this will be fun. So that's what we did. And then I was very lucky that Richard B. Wright, the wonderful Canadian writer, came in to teach English in my second and last year, I think. And he galvanized all of us with an idea of, okay, Graham Greene is this, Shakespeare is that, Evelyn Waugh. And that kind of electrified our interest.
But we had to learn it because it was good for us. I mean, that was the idea behind the pedagogy of the time in English class. But Shakespeare wrote for a mass audience. He wrote for the rabble, he wrote for the literate, he wrote for the illiterate, and so on. Now it seems that Shakespeare, as we've developed or evolved, belongs to the cultural elites in this country and in the world.
Oh, no? I don't think
No, I disagree. I mean, I think that there may be some sense of wanting to be exclusive and coming to a club where we go to Shakespeare. That's all fine, but it's rubbish. Because frankly, Shakespeare was interested in getting as many bums in the seats, getting as much money, and retiring as soon as he possibly could. And you couldn't do that unless you appealed to everybody.
Everybody. But that was then. This is now.
No. Well, listen, we have some of the same issues, and we still have people needing guidance on how to live, right? The problem comes where, as Shauna said, you require skill and technique. You can't just come in off the street. You get a pal of ours, Marvin Caron, does an enormously fundamental and wonderful job here in Toronto in the schools with a thing called Shakespeareans. And he goes in, he says, "You guys think you're afraid of this?" And in a 45-minute session, he's got kids on their feet, directing each other, acting, understanding Shakespeare, and talking the talk, walking the walk. Before you know it. And then, they're in at-risk schools, they're in after-school programs, Shakespeare is guiding them through. So you say, well, wait a minute, 45 minutes ago, they didn't have an acquaintance with this author. Now they get it, they understand the people.
And I think it's because, I think respect rewards, but reverence kills.
Have we been too reverential about Shakespeare?
I think so. I think young actors are reverential. I mean, when I teach...
Or scared.
Only of you.
No, but when I'm teaching them, I go, don't be afraid of this. You have to bring the same skills and appetites and objectives and to Shakespeare as you do any other play, only maybe more, because you have to expand to meet Shakespeare. If you try and bring him down to your everyday existence without using your imagination, then I think
this is what you were saying about being larger than life. It's not just life, it's life lifted. It's life lifted and served up. So all of those characters require, have a look at this. And you got to be compelling if you're going to get somebody to watch you. How do you be compelling? You bring more. I mean, Richard Manette used to talk about what the great tragedies did to actors in terms of training them to be better people and better actors. It's the cost. Finally, it's what are you willing to risk? There was somebody was on a program, a CBC program, I dare say, recently, and she was talking about darkness and difficulty. And the image she used, she said, we have to walk into that darkness and give that trouble legs so it can walk back out again. That's our job. It's not easy. You need expertise. Yeah. You need training. You need a lifetime at it. But finally, when you do that, it's really simple.
And they're plays. I mean, they were meant to be seen, not read. I think so many of our first
But they're poetry as well, though.
It's poetry. But to read a play when you have 15, 20 people and parts, it's a little more difficult to read and understand when you have somebody playing those roles. And they were meant to be seen with a group of people doing it. Then it becomes alive. Then it's not a chore. Then it's fun because those actors should be good enough to lift it off and make you understand it. Even if you might not understand every word, you're going to understand the intention.
All right, I want to play a piece of tape here, Shauna. This is you as Richard III, which in opera is called a trouser role, I guess.
Well, it certainly was in my case.
This was at Stratford in 2011.
The son of Clarence have I pent up close. His daughter meanly have I matched in marriage. The sons of Edward sleep in Abraham's bosom. And Anne, my wife, hath bid this world good night. Now, for I know the Breton Richmond aims at young Elizabeth, my brother's daughter, and by that knot looks proudly on the crown, to her go I, a jolly, thriving wooer.
That's Shauna McKenna at Stratford playing King Richard III. Did you wear a hunchback thing?
Yes.
You did.
Did it
ever slip or didn't?
No, because Peter Hartwell, the designer, and Miles Potter, the director, wanted to be sure that I was not going to injure my body, because many Richards, well, Colm, you came out unscathed, I think, physically, but many Richards have injured their bodies for years, had back issues, leg issues, and so I had a whole corset with a hump that also with a padded one arm, so that it made my right side look stronger, and then my own minimum, the smaller arm, would look very shriveled because it was its own size.
Even in that short clip, we get a sense of the self-awareness, the scheming, the mendacity of the man. Why are Shakespeare's villains so compelling?
Villains
and
are
it seemed
compelling.
To be, yeah, but it's, and you were having fun playing.
Well,
is fun the right word or no?
Yes, absolutely. I think you have to have a blast one way or another. I think, and the great thing about Richard, I think, is Richard is foremost, he's an actor. He plays everybody, and he speaks to the audience to get them on side, and they become complicit, and then they think, aren't we the smartest people in the room? You and I, audience member, we are the smartest people. Watch me how I play them. And then little by little, you realize, I'm laughing at this guy. I don't think I should be laughing at this guy. And when the princes are killed, the audience goes, I'm not so sure. And then he stops talking to the audience.
Do you find that when you played Richard III, Richard III?
Yes, I had my delightful fun time with Richard. I didn't have as much prosthetic equipment because, of course, I broke my arm in childhood, so I just laid it on the table, bent like that. It was very handy. Look what you did to my arm. This is horrible. And I never twisted up until the lights went off. So I would walk around backstage completely and then collapse into the spider shape, which was fun. But
there's that word again, fun.
Oh, no, it's delightful. Yeah. And partly because you're saying, look, hey, you see all these boring people? I'm going to kill them. I'm going to screw some of them. The cute ones I'm going to have sex with. Then I'm not going to keep them long.
Right.
And then, you know, I'll be king and it'll be great. And it turns out it's not great. And as Shauna says, he stops talking to the audience, starts getting much more self-reflective, introspective, and stuff starts to rattle away. So they are delightful. What's one of the most fun things about them is that you as the actor know this is my job, to get the audience to love me, to have a laugh, to do the... And the moment you get them doing that, the rest of the journey, they're stuck. It's like Othello. Yeah. Iago does the same thing. Mm-hmm. He's terribly mean.
They're given the asides. They're the ones who have the immediate the soliloquies to the audience. So they're the ones who share the secrets with the audience.
You know, that's why Spacey's so successful with House of Cards. He has two cameras rolling. Mm-hmm. All the time. And he turns around and goes, what a moron. And then comes right back.
Talks to the audience.
Absolutely. Yeah. That is just the most wacky, perfectly Shakespearean thing going. And it allows you that wonderful duality. You can say, I'm playing lots of layers. I just want you to make sure you understand what the layers are as you turn
to the
side. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Were you, both having played Richard, were you all caught up and engaged when they found him under the parking lot a couple of years ago, the bones?
Yes, I was especially tickled when they said it was a slightly feminine body.
I played it like that. I'm pretty sure that's what the review said. They were just waiting for you around to come in and cap it.
You've seen the parodies that have been done on Shakespeare, the Peter Cook, Jonathan Miller.
Yes.
Saucy Worcester.
You know, something that, you know, can be that revered is obviously, you know, a great target. And something obviously like the Bible, a touchstone, we know the vocabulary.
Yeah.
We have a vocabulary because of Shakespeare. So that they're great as reference points. I mean, I've been in situations where a director... He said, whoa, Kenneth Branagh dropping a great heavy brick. And Tony Hopkins and I, wow, said two knights of the realm. And we were sitting there talking and trying to negotiate a scene in an equally classic adventure, Thor, for Marvel, incidentally, available on DVD. But Kenny was directing us with Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have time to do anything. Yeah. He said, okay, you know Winter's Tale. You know what he goes, oh, yeah, Act 3, fine. Now you... I want Tony, I want a bit of Lear, a bit more of that. Just mm-hmm. draw. And he really directed it with that in mind.
But you would take that direction from a Shakespearean actor more than you would from...
Well, no, if any director came to me and said, you know, mm-hmm. Romeo and Juliet, you know that moment when Mercutio does this, Juliet does that? It's a reference. It's a template mm-hmm. for us to go. Instant recognition. Yes. We know what that journey is like. You know, so do you remember like this part of the Bible where this happens? Yeah. Everybody knows. Bang.
You came into the studio a couple of years ago when you were doing Lear at Stratford. You looked terrible. Your hair was stringy and you were wearing rags. It was embarrassing to sit with you in the... In the studio, it was,
you know, some stuff you just do for love.
I understand,
but that wasn't
not for money.
Costume,
I understand.
It wasn't the costume.
This is a scene from Lear. Now, this is where he feels betrayed at the honesty and the lack of flattering that he gets from Cordelia, who's his favorite daughter, and then he turns around and disowns her.
So young, and so untender.
So young, my lord, and true.
Let it be so. Thy truth, then, be thy dower. For by the sacred radiance of the sun, here I disclaim all my paternal care, propinquity, and property of blood, and as a stranger to my heart and me, hold thee from this forever. The barbarous Scythian, or he that makes his generation messes to gorge his appetite, shall to my bosom be as well neighbored, pitied, and relieved as thou, my sometime daughter.
Good, my liege.
Peace, Kent. Come not between the dragon and his wrath. I loved her most, and thought to set my rest on her kind nursery, hence, and avoid my sight. So be my grave, my peace. As here I give her father's heart from her. Call France. Who stirs? Call Burgundy. Cornwall and Albany, with my two daughters' dowers, digest this third. Let pride, which she calls plainness, marry her.
That's Colin Fiore as King Lear at Stratford a couple of years ago. Is Lear the Everest of Shakespeare's?
I thought it was.
I agree.
I thought it was the hardest thing. It's not a long part, but I thought it was a big part. You know, I challenged myself to do something with it that I hadn't done with other things, and that was to... not plan as much as I sometimes do and attack it live every performance and just see what happened and allow whatever was going on in one's life to influence that. And it took an enormous amount out of me. Yeah. I talked to Ben Campbell shortly after we were having a beer and he just played it. And I said, my God, that was the hardest thing I've ever done. It's killing me. He said, what are you talking about? I loved it. It was easy. I mean, he just seemed to have a really much easier time of it. And I thought, well, clearly he's not doing it right. Because it was just, I found it very, very fulfilling, gratifying, absolutely. He goes so far left, so far right, so deep, so high. He's so lost. That's less sophisticated. Hamlet's sophisticated. It floats. You know, it's up there. It's founded on something profound. But it actually, you know, is a little bit more surface.
When you have that kind of commitment and with your background and technique and talent and all of that over the years, decades perhaps, have you used anything in Shakespeare in your own life, in your own lives? In other words, are your lives personally informed by Shakespeare in some way?
Well, I think when you come into contact with any great artist, whether it's painting or sculpture or and you work on it every day, I think it can't help but influence you. If anything, I think Shakespeare is non-judgmental. That's the great thing about him, as with Tennessee Williams. You know, I'm working on As You Like It right now.
Right.
And the Duke, or in our production, Duchess, comes into the Forest of Arden and experiences hardship and exile and compassion, probably, and goes out of the forest to resume rule. Because she's been with nature, she's listened to herself, she's listened to other things beside the hubbub of the world and ambition of the court, and she goes back a better ruler, I'm sure. And I think Shakespeare is our Arden. That when we're in his presence, whether we're in the theater or even sitting quietly with one of his speeches, we hold that really heavy mirror up to our own natures.
And when you hold that mirror up, it can be disturbing, it can be unnerving or dismaying.
Well, certainly for the people who live with you,
indeed.
because, you know, in the journey of exploration to try and meet and match Shakespeare in, you know, the part that he's given you and the way he wants you to work, you have to ask a lot of yourself. And invariably, if we're doing the big plays, there's darkness and there's difficulty. And I've found that, you know, I've kept a great deal of it home when I perhaps should have let it go at the door. And in the course of my career, I've had various moments where, oh, thank God I was living alone here, because that's gone a bit too far. You know, you try to fake an experience for yourself or generate drama to see if you can approximate an imaginative, you know, connection between you and what the character is going through, which is supposed to be very, very real. And, you know, we twist ourselves into pretzel shapes, believing, as one of our mentors, Michael Mawson, said, in the greater glory of ... The divinity, and I think there is divinity in Shakespeare. Yeah. And the divinity of Shakespeare is that we, in sacrificing ourselves for the character, for the play, to the author's intention, which is what in the purest sense that we do, that we move all of humanity further down the field. And you will sort of take one for the team. And, you know, one of the things that you feel, I mean, what are you going to get in exchange? Well, they pay you and you get to do something extraordinary that you love doing. But you also feel that at the end you come out, I don't do this for applause. I mean, I like it. It's nice if you liked it. I don't do it for applause, but I do enjoy the moment where I come out at the end and I can actually see some of the audience moved to be in the same place I am now. That they've taken this journey with us and that it's undeniable. You simply cannot say anything about Shakespeare other than that he has revealed us to ourselves. And that's an extraordinary thing.
When you and I talked a couple of years ago, I think at one point we were talking about age being congruent with the role, that Shakespeare can blow up a career. If there's a 19-year-old Lear, you're not going to... Is that a concern for you?
Well, as a woman, sure, because in the classical canon, in Shakespeare, as a young woman, most of the major roles in Shakespeare are in your 20s and 30s, maybe your 40s, you know. And then they are reduced in size and responsibility. So you don't have the combination of expertise and size of role and responsibility of leading a company, which was why it was so great to do Richard III, because you had all of that. And also, as a woman, you're usually the emotional vessel in a play.
Right.
Usually. You're not, you just can't stand there and think or actually have a plan or a plot, unless you're one of those unnatural women like Margaret in the Henry VI's or, you know, Tamara, who's plotting and planning. So I think age, I mean, you have some fabulous roles. It must have been written for some extraordinary young men or boys like Cleopatra, which I probably say would rival Lear or Hamlet, you know. So because she is infinite variety. So I think you have to. I mean, I'm playing Jaques right now, and it's a role I asked for 30 years ago, but
now she fits the trousers.
It took a while. Yeah.
It took a while, but you know, but they are different. They are different, and they're wonderful to explore. But I think with age, you finally have the experience where you feel up to the job.
How do you feel? Times change, we evolve, or we don't. People talk about Shakespeare, some of his plays, the controversy of Merchant of Venice. Is Shylock anti-Semitic or not? And Taming of the Shrew, is it sexist? Hamlet says, frailty, thy name is woman. Does that concern you?
No, not at all.
No,
right? I think that when people get excited about these things and there's debate and discussion, which are always good things to have, very often people latch on to the first thing that they hear, frailty, thy name is woman, being one of them. And it tends to take everything out of context. Shakespeare is very clever about keeping things in context. And if he wants you to isolate something and he wants to shine a very interesting light on it, maybe go a little farther than you'd like to, he'll put a framing device with it. It'll be a play within a play. He will isolate and focus. One of the things that I've always believed, that if Shakespeare allows the people, particularly in something like The Shrew, to go off the stage and have sex, he meant for us to believe that that was the relationship to follow.
Right.
Even if it's difficult for us to comprehend. And so finally, it's about a more careful reading. Let us work harder at understanding. And that's really, you know, Sean and our job. We'll figure this out for you. We'll make it clear.
But so the idea that he's sexist or racist or anti-Semitic is... irrelevant, is it?
No, I don't think that it's irrelevant, but I just think, do we have misogyny, racism, bigotry today? And we do. And when we hear those things, we go, oh. And I think, you know, in Merchant of Venice, you also have a very good Jew on stage.
Right.
You have Tubal, who is the balance for Shylock. You're looking at vengeance and you're looking at injustice. And he gives, Shakespeare always gives people who are slightly disenfranchised or who have been treated badly a great speech. Hath not a Jew eyes. Amelia in Othello says, you know, women have appetites too. And Kate in Taming of the Shrew, she says exactly what what Juliet and Portia say, which is, I will lay my fortunes at your feet and follow you, my lord, throughout the world. She says the same thing, but because it's at the end of the play and she's been treated badly. I mean, for me, Shrew, I mean, when I did it, Miles had directed as a spaghetti western, so there were archetypes, as there were commedia archetypes in Taming of the Shrew, and you went, it's the wild Western woman against Graham Abbey's Clint Eastwood, who's coming in his duster, and these two damaged people find sanctuary with each other, which in a way is what marriage is.
You talk about it, exactly this. This is what I talk about, a careful reading. I was looking at a speech recently of Petruchio's when he says, thus have I politically begun my reign, because I'm going to read it for Bill Needle's memorial. And looking again at the speech, and I've been in Taming of the Shrew three times, and I'd missed something. There's a marvelous word, and these are so many words. But he says, another way I have to man my haggard, to make her come and know her keeper's call, that is to watch her as we watch these kites that bait and beat and will not be obedient. And I thought, you know, haggard. I got to look this up. And it was because I was looking at either the Goshawk, the T.H. Whiters, that wonderful new memoir of the woman who bought a hawk when her dad died. I was reading all kinds of things. I said, I must really know what this word means. Well, it turns out a haggard is a bird that's a couple of years old.
No,
so she's actually damaged. She's not a fledgling, just born. You can do whatever you want. She's set in her ways, and she's had a tough time. Mm-hmm. And he says, I recognize that you have gone down this particular road, and it's going to take something really different to bring you back.
And he's just lost his father.
Yeah.
And she looks at him, and he says, well, you're too old for me. And she says, and yet you are withered. Mm. Right?
Tis with cares. And see what I care not. Don't start us.
Sadly, we only have a two-hour program, but I just want to say at the end here, as you start talking about Shakespeare, the emotional level in your voices gets very intense, and it seems to be a barometer rising kind of thing. do you feel that when you're never bored with what he says or what you do in infinite variety, to coin a phrase, but you just seem to be taken over by it.
Well, I think your relationship with Shakespeare is a passionate affair.
Yeah.
For life.
And you want him to have many mistresses. you want everyone to love him as much as you do.
And you're never going to get it right. Never getting it right, I think, is fun. That's what allows you to do these, you know, big challenging plays and parts with an immense sort of freedom, because you think, I don't have to be perfect. I can never be perfect. I will never be definitive. It will just be what I did Tuesday afternoon at 2 o'clock with this fabulous group of people.
And because you're in a long line, there are a lot of people who have come before you.
Well, this is what I'm talking about, cultural learning, that you're actually stealing
and
from
actors,
Henry Irving, from everybody.
And you say, oh, gosh, if I could be like, oh, gosh, I remember Trish Connolly's Viola, or I remember, and you think...
Or Burbage.
But I think fundamentally we are, because that's the way it's been passed on.
Yeah.
I walked on doing a brilliant piece in the Mercutio that I did in Cimolino's Romeo and Juliet, and I thought I'd killed it. I walked off stage, and Bernard Hopkins said, the Richardson of 53. Very good choice. You're killing me. This was original. I just made this up. No, alas, you didn't.
And what you will hope for is that there will be people still trotting the footsteps that you've kind of left a little bit in the sand.
Well, you both have, and it's been an absolute delight to have you in the studio this morning. And I haven't even had to pay you scale. I've sat here and enjoyed your...
Yeah, you just had to ask.
That's wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Shauna McKenna has appeared in dozens of plays at Stratford Festival over three decades in roles from Lady Macbeth to Richard III this season at Stratford. She's appearing in As You Like It and Ibsen's John Gabriel Borkman. And Colin Fior has played Pierre Trudeau and Glenn Gould to much acclaim on screen and at Stratford. His roles have included Richard III, Hamlet, Macbeth and King Lear. They were both with me in our studio in Toronto this morning. You're listening to the Sunday Edition across Canada on CBC Radio 1 and across North America on Sirius Satellite XM Radio. My name is Michael Enright.